Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to The Leading Tone podcast. Today, we bring you the fifth episode of our Top 100 Composer series, this time going over composers 41 through 50 of our average Top 100 list. This list is exclusive to composers within the classical canon, so basically anything but jazz or pop. But before we get into that list, let's go ahead and guess that lick.
Guess that lick, or there's no prize.
Welcome to Guess That Lick, our weekly quiz show that tests our musical memory. Each of us will bring an isolated excerpt of music, either from a recording or just a piano track recording, and the other co-host will have three listens to guess that lick. For a maximum of 5 points per episode, here is the scoring breakdown. 1 point each for the piece, the movement, the composer, the time period, and the genre.
Right, and we would like to announce our results from the October section of Guess That Lick. For the month of October, Fernando was able to pull out with a narrow victory. He got a total of 10 points, and then I had a total of 9 points. So congratulations to Fernando. He guessed that lick better than me. But now we start the new month. Lifetime currently, I have 18 points and Fernando's in the lead with 25 points, but I am poised to hopefully get all 5 points today and catch back up, at least get close.
Right. I'm one guess ahead so far, so today we'll be evening it out and hopefully you can get pretty close.
Hopefully. We'll see.
All right. Let's go ahead and give you your first listen. All right, that was the first listen. What do you want to go ahead and start with here?
Well, I definitely can knock out a few of these. Definitely orchestral work. The time period is early romantic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's give the audiences a second listen here. I feel like I could fill out the rest of these. It's a pretty recognizable excerpt from the introduction of a work, but I'll give the audience another listen.
All right, listen number two. All right, the second listen for the audience. You want to go ahead and fill it out?
Yeah, let's go ahead and fill out all of this. So this is Felix Mendelssohn's Fingal's Cave Overture, and it's the it's from the introduction, the very beginning of the work, and early romantic orchestral work. Really, really great work and really fun melodically. This is a great excerpt.
Seems like you got all of it right here. This part was from the introduction. It does come up, that motif does come up throughout the whole piece, actually.
Yeah.
It comes up a couple times. But this one was specifically from the introduction. So we'll give you the point for the movement, because there's no movement here. You've earned it this time, identifying it as the introductory material.
So that means I'm catching up here. That puts me at a total of 23 points to your lifetime 25. And for the start of November, currently in the lead here.
Mm-hmm.
So 5 points for me for the month of November. Whatever I bring you next week, I'll try to make it a good one, just like this one. So,
all right, great.
We hope that you all had fun trying to guess that lick with us again this week. Let's go ahead and move on to today's topic. Welcome to today's topic. Like we said earlier, this is our fifth edition of the Top 100 Composers series. This time we're going over composers 41 through 50 of our average list. And this list is exclusive to composers within the classical canon, so basically anything but pop or jazz. We want to make that distinction pretty clear because this isn't our top 100 favorite musicians and artists of all time. This is just composers in that classical canon. So if we're leaving out some of your favorites, that's probably why.
Right. And it's just our personal preferences.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of these throughout this process kind of swing around a little bit. And this list in particular, I feel like there's a good bit of these that I've come around to since we established this list.
Right. It's really funny. We've already started restructuring our lists for when we finish. We're going to present a revised list after going through and researching and talking about all of these composers.
Absolutely. And I hope this first one ends up ranking a little bit higher on your list, actually. So composer number 41, the first one we're going to go over today, is Giacomo Puccini, ranked number 32 on my list and 75 on Fernando's list. So pretty big disparity there.
Yeah, this group here today, they have, I think, the biggest or widest variance that we've talked about so far, and we'll get an even bigger one later, or a couple later. But yeah, this is the first big one here. So yeah, Puccini, Italian romantic composer, kind of late romantic into the 20th century a little bit. He's really well known for his operas, and that's kind of my rationale here. I really do love his operas. He's got iconic operas, some of the best, some of the most well-known operas with great themes and very well-known arias. But he was primarily an opera composer, branched out a little bit. But because he's kind of just in that opera field for most of his compositional career, it keeps him a little bit lower on my list. I don't find myself listening to opera as much. Sometimes it comes in the rotation, and when it does, it comes in pretty heavy, and I'll be listening to a lot of it. But consistently, I don't listen to it that much, so that's why he ended up a little bit lower on my list when I was writing it.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that Puccini wrote so many beloved operas and gorgeous melodies. La Boheme, Tosca, Madame Butterfly, and Turandot are all really great examples of his unique voice in Italian opera. He's kind of seen as inheriting that from Verdi a little bit, but I think he refines it, and certainly his music has remained popular in the opera genre. I mean, they're among some of the most performed.
In a way, I see Puccini's operas as almost the pinnacle of Italian opera. It's kind the peak, because he's kind of the last opera composer, especially from Italy, that is really well known.
Right.
Right. Otherwise, we'd have to start talking about 20th century opera composers, and opera of the 20th century is so different from the Romantic period, the late Romantic period, anything that Puccini was writing.
Right.
It's very different. So I think it is, in a way, kind of the end of an era.
Oh, I totally agree. And Turandot being one of his final operas is a great indicator of that, because it's starting to have a little bit more of that 20th century influence, I think Hindemith particularly.
Right, exactly. Well, let's go ahead and take a listen to what his style of opera kind of sounded like. This is one of his more mature works, La Boheme. This is just an excerpt from it. Let's take a listen.
Schnell zusammen mit diesem Diesel. vai di me tristezza e c'è di sole io passo a parare ogni di tu perstecchi.
All right, so just a little bit of La Boheme there. Fun little opera by Puccini, one of his later works, a more mature work from Puccini. One of the most well-known operas of his. For me, when we were just listening to it, it has a way of sounding like what we think of as musicals today, right? It has similarities to musicals. So maybe musicals kind of took an inspiration from Puccini's operas. It would make sense. They're both dramatic works. They're both musical works. So it kind of works together well. Funny enough, I thought of the musical Oklahoma with the way that the soloists are singing and then the chorus kind of interrupts and it's kind of constantly changing to a different direction, a different style, and the focus is kind of changing a little bit. But really any musical has some of those moments.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. And I was thinking it's kind of that intersection between Italian opera and 20th century music. But I think that's a great point that at this point you're starting to have kind of the birth of musicals as a genre. It's starting to at least start to pop up towards the end of Puccini's life. So it's interesting that his work is kind of surviving in that genre.
Right. And of course, it can kind of work both ways where he's hearing newer music and he actually did hear some newer music and was influenced by that. So let's kind of get into that a little bit more. I have some notes on that here. So going back to the very beginning of Puccini's life, he was first really influenced by Verdi's Aida when he saw it in Pisa in 1876. And that kind of really convinced him that opera was his passion and what he really wanted to do with his life.
That's a good one.
So. Right. I would say that one's pretty convincing. It obviously convinced Puccini enough to go on to write many operas and to actually study at the Milan Conservatory. And at the Milan Conservatory, he actually studied with Ponchielli, the composer of La Gioconda, another famous opera. So another famous opera composer there. He studied with a few others, but that one stood out to me. In 1883, Puccini graduates from the conservatory, the Milan Conservatory. And in that same year, he actually enters Le Villi into a one-act opera competition.
That's a great one.
Yeah, it is a great one. But the judges didn't think so. They didn't really like it too much. They didn't find it worthy of consideration. But a group of his friends collected some money together and produced it on their own. And the premiere actually was met with great success at Milan's Verma Theater on May 31st, 1884. So a year later, after he had kind of finished it up for the competition. And it was so impressive and so successful to the audience that the music publisher Giulio Ricordi immediately acquired the copyright and he asked Puccini to continue it to make it more than just a one-act opera but a two-act opera. He also commissioned Puccini to write another opera for La Scala, a big and important opera house in Italy, and he gave him a monthly stipend for that. And that kind of started Puccini's relationship with Giulio Ricordi, who was a really great friend, a lifelong friend of Puccini, and kind of just a cohort in that way.
Right. So here you have his second opera, Edgar, didn't really have that successful of a premiere. So already we're having a lot of ups and downs. But Ricordi continued to have faith in Puccini and sent him to Bayreuth in Germany to hear Wagner's Die Meistersinger, which this probably led Puccini to really carefully select the subjects for his operas and take more time writing his librettos like Wagner. And that kind of leads to La Boheme and Tosca and Madame Butterfly. And they certainly benefited from that and had more success because of this change in his approach there.
Right, exactly. And so a little bit later in his life, he starts getting really interested in some of his contemporaries' works. Some people like Claude Debussy, Richard Strauss, Arnold Schoenberg, and Igor Stravinsky. Slightly more modern takes. All of them do have their own operas, and they're a little bit more obscure in their own ways, very unique to each composer. And those studies of his contemporary scores would actually influence his later compositions, Il Trittico and Turandot. So, interesting influences there, leading to his latest works. Turandot actually does not get finished by Puccini. He unfortunately passed away before he could complete it, but Toscanini actually did still premiere the work. The premiere stopped at the point that Puccini had stopped composing the music, but now we have revised and finished versions that were completed by others.
We have a little bit more interesting facts about Puccini before we move on here. A little bit of a scandal here.
Right, exactly. So Puccini actually was born and raised in Lucca, and he lived there for his youth and ended up fleeing his birthplace with a married woman, Elvira Gemignani. And they moved around a lot before the husband of this woman died. And the two were able to marry at that point because she was no longer a married woman. After that turn of the century, they had moved around. They'd lived together for a while. Elvira unexpectedly becomes jealous of a servant from the village, Doria Manfredi, who had been employed by the Puccinis for a while, for several years. And Elvira actually drives Doria from the house, threatening to kill her. And Doria does not take this well. She actually poisons herself. And her parents had the body examined by a physician who declared her to be a virgin, so Puccini did not have any influence there. So the Manfredis, Doria's parents, brought charges against Elvira Puccini for persecution and calumny, creating one of the most famous scandals of all time. Elvira was found guilty, but through the negotiations of the lawyers was not sentenced, and Puccini paid damages to the Manfredis, who withdrew their accusations. Eventually, the Puccinis adjusted themselves to just living together, but the composer kind of wanted to be free to do his own thing and didn't really want to be associated with her after that.
Right, and it just goes to show that, I mean, these people are human and they have struggles and problems just like we do, but it maybe not everybody to this extent, but it certainly is a lot, for sure.
Yeah, a lot of personal problems, and who knows, that could have influenced Puccini's operas in some way, his compositions in some way, especially because they were so frequently driven by themes of love and very dramatic concepts.
Right, so that's certainly dramatic. So,
right.
Great example there. Well, we hope that you enjoyed all of our information on Giacomo Puccini. Let's go ahead and move on to number 42 on our list, Manuel de Falla. Number 62 on my list, and 48 on Fernando, so pretty close. This is a Spanish turn-of-the-century composer, lived from 1876 to 1946. Fernando, tell us what you like about de Falla.
Well, I really think that de Falla is one of the most important composers of Spain in that turn-of-the-century, 20th-century time period. He really mixed Spanish folk music with more modern and abstract concepts. Unfortunately, he had kind of a limited output as far as his compositions go, but I still really enjoy the music, and I have a special connection with the music because I have Spanish heritage, so I kind of identify with it a little bit more than some others might, but even just overall, I think de Falla takes a really fun twist to a lot of Spanish folk music and a lot of just some fun, obscure melodies that he's come up with and kind of goes along with some of the artistic themes of the time, I think, as well.
Oh, totally agree. And there's a reason why de Falla has kind of a modest output, which we'll talk about towards the end here. But despite that, I think that this is one that I'm still becoming a little bit more familiar with and falling in love with, but there's a couple of these pieces here that really stand out to me, and he really does have such a unique voice amongst the composers of this time period. That's why we kind of categorize him as a turn-of-the-century composer here, because he certainly is standing out amongst some more maybe romantic, late romantic contemporaries, and then really, really 20th century, really experimental music, but he's kind of in the middle here, and it's this really cool middle ground to fall in. We both love that kind of music, so.
Right, yeah, big fan of that kind of music from that time period. So, without further ado, let's go ahead and listen to some of de Falla's music. We have for you Fantasia Bética, which is a piano work. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
That was Defaya's Fantasia Bética, a piano work, and a demanding one at that, a very challenging piano work there, and definitely does not seem to be in any way romantic period, right? It's very complex and, like I said, challenging for the pianist and demanding. It's an incredible work, a very fun work, and it imitates that Spanish guitar sound.
Absolutely. I think that that's the big takeaway from this. There's so many licks in here that I'm like, oh, that's totally a Spanish guitar sounding lick. Definitely some really, really great Spanish influence music here. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of his non-Spanish influences as well, because the coolest thing about Defaya is that he not only has the Spanish influence, but he also has a lot of great international influences from his time in Paris. So he's born in Cadiz, Spain, and Defaya had an early interest in music. He studied piano with his mother, and he actually aspired to be an author in his early years. And he went on to write various articles about his music and librettos for his work throughout his life. So this definitely paid off, a great skill. And just goes to show you the interdisciplinary side of music is huge, and it only enhances your musical abilities if you're well-versed in other disciplines as well. So great for Defaya there. While he's in Paris, he's able to meet and befriend Ravel, Stravinsky, Florence Schmidt, Debussy, Diaghilev, and Dukas. So the Spanish folk elements meeting these really 20th century influences is great. I mean, it goes on to shape a lot of his music, I think.
Right, and that group of composers and Diaghilev, who's more of the person paying for all of the projects that they're doing, all of those people together, they kind of have their own group of artists, right? They have a very clear vision of what they want to do with their work, and it's very fresh for the time. It's very new for the time, and taking music in a very distinct direction. That's what I like so much about the turn of the century period there. I feel like this was one direction that music was going, and it would have only happened with Defaya and Ravel and Debussy and Stravinsky at the helm.
Absolutely, yeah. You would definitely not have seen this kind of path in music if it wasn't for composers like Defaya. When he returns to Spain, he writes El Amor Brujo, one of his most famous works upon his return. And then I've listed a couple other of notable works here. Retablo and Antolita are two other works that brought him a lot of fame. Retablo is a puppet opera based off of Don Quixote, and it's only around 27 minutes long, and it features extensively challenging roles and use of puppets. So this one was one that caught a lot of people's attention, but didn't get programmed that often because you've got to have puppeteers and you've got to have the singers with the chops to really pull this one off. But it's so cool. Take a listen to it on Spotify at some point if you can. It's really, really great. And Antolita, which is a stage cantata that's based off of the Catalan poem of the same name, features a lot of Spanish and Greek influences. Really interesting mix there. So I thought these were two that were worth noting for sure that are kind of unique.
Right. They are very unique. And it shows that Defaya was trying to do something different. And it definitely shows in these two that he's working with folk elements like Don Quixote, which is a very classic tale in Spain. Yeah. And he's working with the Spanish and Greek influences and the Catalan poem. Really great, but still diverse selection to start from. And then he's just kind of putting his own twist on it, which is really fun.
Right. And unfortunately, he does not have as extensive of an output as some other composers on this list, partly due to the fact that the turmoil in Spain at the time, there's the Spanish Civil War, and there was a lot of elements that just prevented him from composing as much as he would like to. But I'd like to picture a world where Defaya did get to write all that he wanted to. And I mean, quite frankly, that would have been a great world to live in. But not so, unfortunately. We're left with a lot of great music by Defaya, and certainly it has stood the test of time and is amongst the highlights of classical music from Spain.
Also, I wanted to bring up the fact that Defaya is also kind of a contemporary of Picasso. They both lived in that same time period, around the same age, just separated by a couple years. And I think that you can see similarities between the paintings of Picasso and the music of Defia, there's always that Spanish element to both of their works, but especially when you go post-war, post-Spanish Civil War, there's something about it that has that sadness. It has this sadness or sorrow to it,
right,
that is just a result of such a devastating event.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point there with Picasso and Defia. I think that you can see a lot of similarities between that art and the art of Defia, the interdisciplinary thing going on here.
So. Right, and they both have this kind of abstraction of concepts, right? They're taking ideas and kind of drawing upon it and abstracting the idea to make it recognizable, but only slightly.
Right.
And that's what I really enjoy about Defia's music.
Yeah, Retablo is a great example of that. Defia is a really interesting one. You need to check out more of his music for sure. Now, let's go ahead and rewind here in history a bit. Composer number 43, some of you might be shocked to hear this composer this low on our list, Johann Sebastian Bach, number 34 on my list and 78 on Fernando. So kind of a big disparity there, but I think we can both agree that Bach's music, the influence of Bach's music is huge, and that cannot be disputed.
Right, exactly. Completely agreed there. A reminder, a disclaimer, this is only our personal preferences in composers. It's not a rating of how great they are as a composer. Bach was certainly great and has quite the influence on many composers over time. Some of the composers that we like a little bit more and we've ranked a little bit higher. The reasons I like Bach's music, because I do like Bach's music, even though he ranked 78 on this list at the time of writing it, is because he's an icon of Baroque music, specifically late Baroque music. If you want to know what late Baroque music sounded like, you listen to Bach. That is what most of the composers were composing like, and those are the kinds of sounds that you'd hear. Bach is actually a really great example of a composer that was drawing on other influences from around him. He wasn't just coming up with all the ideas straight out of nowhere. He was taking ideas from other places that he would go to and fuse those into his sacred music, and sometimes his secular music as well. And it's the way that he organizes his music that is particularly spectacular.
Right.
Right. And so I enjoy that element of his music. He also helped establish the modern tonal system as we know it today. So that's kind of an important factor there.
Absolutely. And I think that's my whole rationale there is that his influence on the music industry is just too staggering to not have him on the place and on my list. And in addition, I find myself listening to Bach a lot more within the last year and appreciating his music than I have ever. So if you had asked me probably a year ago, I'm like, yeah, I like Bach's music. But now I think I'm really starting to fall in love with Bach's music. I think there's this uniqueness to the way that he approaches the keyboard in particular. It's just astounding to me. And there's such beauty and elegance in his writing, and the influence on the industry is just second to none. And our academic music systems, I mean, in colleges around the world are based around his music. We're analyzing his music. We're trying to write music like his to get started. So I think it's important to talk about Bach on the show, and we'll definitely talk about Bach some more on the show. Let's go ahead and take a listen to some of Bach's music. This is part of a larger work, his Toccata, Adagio, and Fugue in C major, and he wrote a whole lot of toccatas and fugues throughout his career, but this one in particular we felt was really, really special, and there's a great band transcription of this work, but we're going to listen to the original version of this. We're going to just listen to the toccata section. Let's take a listen. Thank you. was Johann Sebastian Bach's Toccata, Adagio, and Fugue in C major, BWV 564.
A very Bach example here. I mean, it's got the counterpoint, it's got the technicality, it's got the demand to be extremely accurate and still musical. That's one of the most important things about performing Bach.
Right.
You have to still make it musical. Bach, it's so easy to approach his music from this very analytical and nearly scientific perspective, but you have to keep in mind that it's still music.
Right, and that's really important with all of Bach's work in particular. But what I love so much about this one is the little tunes that creep up. And they've been kind of my earworms in the last week. I've been listening to the band transcription of this quite a bit. And I'm like, man, these little tunes that just pop up, I'm like, oh, that's actually really catchy and fun. And it'll just be these little fragments that he plays with, and then it'll show up somewhere else. It'll be on the top line at one point, and then it'll show up in the lower parts. And I'm just like, oh, wow, that's really, really clever and well done. But you have to dig a little bit to find those tunes. And that's why there are so many Bach diehards out there, including Felix Mendelssohn.
Right. Mendelssohn was quite the fan of Bach and kind of responsible for bringing Bach's music to the attention of the public and to the academic side of music. He was a very big proponent of Bach's music and definitely promoted it in a way that led to us now having Bach in every music textbook.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's really worth noting that's also kind of why Mendelssohn is ranked higher on our list, because I think Mendelssohn takes a lot of elements of what works so well with Bach and really iterated upon it. I guess that's kind of the point of him being such a romantic composer, even though he is on the conservative spectrum of that. But that's worth noting for sure.
Right. Bach wasn't even as popular as some other composers in his time when he was alive. There were some composers out there that were sought after a little bit more. One position in particular, there was a church that wanted Telemann, and they had to settle for Bach. So some people might find that humorous, but that's just how it was at the time and how they saw music and composers and organists at the time.
Right.
So I think that's an important or significant factor from history that can be overlooked sometimes, but that's not to say that Bach's music isn't spectacular in its own way. It definitely is, and that's, again, why Mendelssohn loved it so much and why so many other composers and fans of classical music love it so much.
So you heard it from Fernando first. Telemann over Bach. So no, but both are great composers and musicians of their own right in their time, for sure.
Right, don't use that against me.
Bach, like we said, he's known for being a composer and an organist who defined the Baroque period of music, which the end of the Baroque period is even defined by his death in 1750. So that's pretty huge there, and also an important fact to just know. His legendary virtuosity on keyboard instruments kind of led him to international fame, more so posthumously even. And then, despite this, many don't know the majority of his career was kind of spent in a very small section of Germany, including Leipzig, Weimar, and Mühlhausen. So that's kind of important to note. He really was not going too far outside of those boundaries there. His work has gone on to be the basis of academic music everywhere, so this list would not be complete without Bach. And also, it's worth noting that he had 13 children.
Yeah, 13 children, and that was not as outrageous as it is today as it was at the time. I think they had to try a lot more to have children, and
right,
there were different reasons to have children and different beliefs and religious views that would contribute to Bach's large family.
Well, what's notable about Bach having so many children is that a lot of them went on to be great composers and musicians of their own right, including Wilhelm Friedemann and Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. So I think that it's worth noting that he was also father to some great composers, so he definitely taught them well. All right, well, we could talk about Bach for a very long time, but let's go ahead and move on to another really interesting composer of keyboard music, and that is Eric Satie, French turn-of-the-century composer, ranked number 48 on my list and 64 on Fernando's list. So he lived from 1866 to 1925. That's kind of why we categorize him in this turn-of-the-century kind of style, because he's definitely not romantic, but he's not quite completely 20th century in a lot of ways. So Satie is, to me, this kind of, he's this master of this French ambiguity in a way that's really resonated with a lot of people around the world, and making him this kind of avant-garde composer that has become surprisingly accessible, I think, in a lot of ways, because his music is often, particularly his Jeunopédies, are related to deep relaxation. And anytime I pull up like a relaxation playlist on Spotify or YouTube, it's like Satie is right there with his Jeunopédies. So I think that his music has kind of lived on in that way.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's funny because he was, I think, much more interested in kind of the avant-garde and kind of the more abstract and obscure things in life and in art.
So it's just funny that his music ended up being popular
in a
way when, like, that was not really what he was about.
Well, it's definitely the more tame works. Overall, his music was known for that minimalism, which is kind of more the relaxing music. But then you have some more repetitive music, like his Vexations, which is extraordinarily repetitive. If you haven't heard of that one, check that out. He also had a strong interest and involvement in the Theater of the Absurd, which...
By title alone,
right, is absurd, right? They were interested in that kind of surrealism and just really wacky things. And Satie is also one of the first people, or possibly the first person, to kind of invent furniture music, which is kind of just music that you just play casually, kind of not music to be listened to intently, but just kind of background music, intentionally written to be background music. So, but still academically. So it's very, you know, a very interesting purpose for the music, a very interesting reason to compose this music. With all that being said, he's best known for his Gymnopédies and his Nociennes. And so today we have one of these Gymnopédies, probably the most famous one, the first one. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
That was Eric Satie's Gymnopédie No. 1. I'm sure you're feeling quite relaxed after that one. It's a very relaxed feeling to the whole piece of music, and just a really pleasant and laid-back type feeling. Definitely could see some experimentation with some drugs here, possibly. I mean, from Satie. It definitely could have been a possibility here. But it's just a really beautiful melody over a very interesting harmonic structure, different, adventurous for the time in a way, because it has kind of those extensions that you wouldn't particularly hear from some composers directly before Satie.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely the lack of romantic influence here. I think that the influence from the Romantic period stems from the melody and nothing to do with the harmony. Maybe the melody and the accompaniment,
right?
The figure, but the harmonic language that's being used, it's much more akin to what you'd hear in jazz.
Right, yeah, very much similar to some jazz music that you might hear.
So Satie, he enrolls in the Paris Conservatory in 1879, studying the piano. And the professors at the conservatory actually did not believe him to have a great talent at the instrument or a great work ethic in particular. So he was, in fact, actually encouraged to be a composer. That's where they felt his strength was. So then Satie enters the military in 1885 after he comes back to the conservatory for a little bit, and then he goes into the military. He was sent home after deliberately infecting himself with bronchitis. So
right.
He really did not like the military. And that's surprisingly not the only composer on today's list that also faked his way out of the military. So right. Found that to be interesting.
Right. Yeah. And that shows that he was definitely a risk taker in a way. I mean, infecting yourself with bronchitis, that's kind
especially at the time. Yeah. You have bronchitis and it's like, that's almost the kind of a death wish. It's serious now.
Right. And he's also just a really odd guy. A really odd guy because, I mean, I don't think most people would think, oh, you know how I'm going to get out of the military? I'm going to get bronchitis on purpose. I'm going to go get bronchitis from somebody.
So that's pretty interesting there. So he actually comes back to the Paris Conservatory finally at age 40, and he did quite well. Top of his class, and he graduates in 1905. So some people don't know that Satie actually, he did have quite a bit of his writing that survived, including his memoirs of an amnesiac, and we have an excerpt from that here. And if this doesn't describe Satie's approach to music, I don't know what does. So Satie said, "Everyone will tell you that I am not a musician. That is correct. From the very beginning of my career, I classed myself as a phonometrographer. My work is completely phonometrical. Science is the dominating factor. I think I can say that phonology is superior to music. There's more variety to it. The financial return is greater, too, and I owe my fortune to it." So he's already, like, you could tell that he's quite into the concept of music, but music as a language, music as something that is more in the phonics of it, not so much the what's on the page and what's on the staff. He's thinking of it as this kind of second language, this form of communication. And that just shows you how unique of a guy he is.
It also shows his approach to composing music. And also, I think it shows that his big distaste for classifying himself as a musician comes from the rules of music that were established by this time, and probably why he didn't do well. That's probably why he didn't do well the first time around in the Paris Conservatory, because he didn't want to stick to the rules that they were trying to give him. You know, this is the dominant and this is the right. tonic, and you have to go from dominant to tonic and
but
stuff like that.
Hang on, how many sevenths? Right.
Right. Right. He was more interested in how things sounded and how to make good sounds.
Right.
Or interesting sounds, at least, rather than adhering to all of the rules of music and the math and science of music. He was more interested in the math and science of sound in
right.
general.
Yeah, the literary kind of side of it is that's really important there. So you have a little bit about this this last little settee story here, a cool little one here. Let's hear it, Fernando.
Right. Well, it's really just this one work that Satie worked on. So Satie actually has a ballet called Parade, and it was actually a collaboration with Pablo Picasso. Here he is popping up again.
Yeah.
For me, I see Defia and Satie in a very similar camp. They're both very, very much going for a little bit more of an abstract, and definitely more so for Satie, an avant-garde type sound. And I think that it pairs so nicely with Picasso in this case, both of their music. But in this ballet, in Parade, Picasso actually did the, I think, the set design, but definitely the costumes. And you'll see, if you find a video of it, which there are some videos on YouTube, you'll see that the costumes are undeniably Picasso. They have the cubist features, features that you'd expect from Picasso's paintings, but in three-dimensional costumes.
That's so cool.
And it makes it look a little bit goofy, but a little bit whimsical in a way. And
right.
I really enjoy it.
Which is totally what they were going for. I mean,
right.
That's just so much both of their personalities, I think.
Right, exactly. They were both going for something a little bit more abstract and avant-garde in a way. And I see that in a lot of Satie's music. That's what I enjoy the most about Satie's music, his more abstract and avant-garde works. Kind of a predecessor of John Cage and that type of pushing the limits of music.
So a good jumping on point for Erik Satie, if you're looking to get into that kind of music, listening to his music, not only does he have a lot of great relaxing stuff like you heard today with the Gymnopédies, but also some more whimsical and wild stuff that will certainly pave a path for composers moving forward. So that's a lot on Erik Satie. Definitely really interesting there. Let's move on to the next composer that got himself out of the military. This is Sir Malcolm Arnold, number 50 on my list and 66 on Fernando, so pretty close. He's an English 20th century composer, born in 1921, passed away within the last 15 years, 2006. So interesting to note there. For me, Malcolm Arnold is so high on my list, largely in part to the work of John Painter, who has transcribed a lot of his popular works for the wind band. That is completely how I was exposed to the work of Malcolm Arnold. His Four Scottish Dances, Tam O'Shanter, Prelude, Siciliano and Rondo, and then some other cool works by him, some more chamber-oriented works, his English Dances and Three Shanties. And he's written quite a few famous solo works, including the Malcolm Arnold Fantasy for Trombone, which is very, very famous, and quite a fun one.
Right, and he's also got a trumpet concerto as well.
Yes.
which is a fun one. Hard to find, though. For me, Malcolm Arnold, he has a very light and popular style to his music, kind of similar to like a Leroy Anderson in the United States. He was kind of doing a similar thing, just a little bit more contemporary and 20th century inspired. But it definitely has these elements that are, for me, pop sounding in a way, which I really enjoy it. It's really great melodies and orchestration, very tuneful works. Really extensive catalog. He does have a lot for all types of ensembles, which is really great.
Yeah, 9 symphonies as well that
right.
most don't know. And I've just started to kind of sink my teeth into those, and I'm like, all right, these are pretty legit.
Right, very much so. If he had branched out a little bit more to some more contemporary styles or doing something a little bit more maybe abstract like Satie, I don't know.
Yeah.
then maybe he would have been a little bit higher for me. But a little fun fact, I had mentioned his trumpet concerto. He actually began his career as a professional trumpeter.
Right. Yeah, that's important to note. And he writes some pretty cool trumpet parts. So.
Right.
So we don't have any listening for Sir Malcolm Arnold today, unfortunately. The cutoff for what's public domain in the United States is kind of towards the beginning of his life, 1921 he was born, so we don't have any music to listen to today, but we hope to eventually on the show. So he studied at the Royal College of Music, just like Ray Vaughan Williams and Gustav Holst we talked about extensively on the show. He studied trumpet with Ernest Hall, and then composition, notably with Gordon Jacob. So that ended up being kind of a big influence there. And you can definitely hear that. And it's funny because Gordon Jacob and Malcolm Arnold both have works that really are popular in the band genre in particular.
I think it's just that British system of schooling and
right.
and composing as well.
Yeah, I mean, and the military band in Britain at the time was really, really getting kind of big because Holst and Vaughan Williams are writing music for them. So Malcolm Arnold, while he didn't write a whole lot of stuff directly for band, a lot of his stuff was transcribed and fit in right at home. It was perfect for the band.
Right.
So he served in the war effort in World War II, was not too happy with it. So he shot himself in the foot to end his service. How about it?
That's one way to do it.
Yeah, back to back, we have Satie and we have Sir Malcolm Arnold finding any way possible. Satie was all meticulous and he's like, okay, I need to figure out how to get bronchitis. I don't know how he did. But then Malcolm Arnold's just like, well, I have this rifle here, and here's an easy way for me to get out. So he shoots himself in the foot and then is done.
Right, the direct approach.
Yes, so I think that explains to you the difference between these two composers here. He won the Mendelssohn Scholarship for composition in 1948, so no longer did he have to rely on his career as a trumpet player, which up until this time, that was kind of a big thing for Malcolm Arnold, and that was how he got a lot of his income. So now he could compose basically full-time. From this point on, he writes 6 film scores a year for like the next 20 years, and then he's writing a lot of great symphonic work. And with all these influences from Holst and Vaughan Williams and Gordon Jacob, as well as some of what was cited as some of its big international influences, which you'll definitely hear these in his symphonies, Tchaikovsky, Mahler, Sibelius, Berlioz. I love how these influences come together in his music, and I'm just now starting to get into those 9 symphonies, like I said, and they're just... you can hear a lot of that kind of influence, particularly, I would say, the Tchaikovsky or the Sibelius combined with that British sound.
Yeah, excellently put. I have to listen to some of those symphonies a little bit more because I'm not as familiar with them either.
There's a lot.
So yeah, I know.
It's a lot to dive into, and it's so tough to keep track of all of this stuff because, I mean, well, we'll have to do some more like underrated symphonies episodes to like really expose people to some works like this. Because they're really cool and they deserve recognition. Unfortunately, I don't think they're really getting programmed all too much. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen these on a program. So.
Right. Well, and it's funny because it's so hard to find a recording, too, of some of these works because,
right.
Because people just aren't playing it.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's actually kind of a good segue into our next composer here. Talk about underrated symphonies. William Schumann, number 46 on our list, and he ranks 69 on my list and 49 on Fernando's. He's taken a big jump when I rewrite this list. He's an American 20th century composer from 1910 to 1992. He has these really, really great symphonies and his piano concerto that are, to me, very reminiscent of the work of Aaron Copland, which we'll kind of have a little bit of a back and forth about here in a little bit. I'm still pretty new to his music. I had known his work for band, for wind band, for a little bit, but this orchestral stuff, man, I think it does show off a lot of influences from Aaron Copland as well as Bernstein and composers like Paul Hindemith as well.
Right, and those diverse influences led him to composing a lot of diverse genres. A lot of people will be familiar with William Schumann's name in the wind band scene, but like you said, the orchestral music of Schumann is equally, if not even more, exceptional. It's harmonically engaging, it's orchestrated so well. He definitely knew what he was doing when writing those string parts because they just lay on the instrument so well, at least to my ear. His band works are extremely important. They're part of the standard wind band rep. And like we said, just an underrated orchestral composer.
Absolutely, yeah. So unfortunately, we don't have any listening for you today. But we'll kind of replace that with a little bit of a discussion. Now, you mentioned to me earlier, Fernando, that his music reminds you a little bit more of that American sound combined with something that's a little bit more like Bartok, maybe.
Right, yeah. I think it has definitely some influences from his contemporary Aaron Copland, but I think it also has some influences from those European contemporaries such as Bartók in the way that some of the orchestration is done and some of the motifs are developed and
right.
the harmonies. Sometimes it just has that sound that is reminiscent of Bartók, and this is particularly in the orchestral music because that's kind of the similarity between the two,
right.
or the strongest similarity between the two. And it comes from more than just Bartók too, and from what I was hearing, and that was just from a very selected listening from a couple of these symphonies of William Schumann. I can definitely hear the influence from some European composers as well as some of the earlier American composers too. For example, Charles Ives,
right.
who William Schumann actually did an arrangement of Variations on America.
Right, which is pretty famous.
Yeah, which is pretty famous and frequently played. So yeah, I think he probably was drawing on a lot of influences from composers that were living at the same time as him, but also some that predated him by just a little bit.
So let's talk a little bit about some of these influences here. So throughout William Schumann's early years, he's actually writing a lot of popular songs for the time, so kind of the pop music of the time. And after he attends a New York Philharmonic concert that's conducted by Toscanini, he actually drops out of New York University and he begins taking composition lessons. So it affected him so much that he's like, yeah, okay, well, music's what I want to do. So he regroups a little bit. Then he goes back to school at Columbia University where he gets his bachelor's and master's degrees in music. So now he's making correspondence with Aaron Copland, who he's met a few times through his career. And Copland actually had Schumann send his second symphony to Sergei Koussevitzky, who was the conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra famously, and the BSO ended up programming many of his works throughout his lifetime, so he's getting his orchestral works played by one of the leading orchestras of the country, so that's pretty legit there. And during this time he's also developing a friendship with Leonard Bernstein, so he's just making all of the connections here, and it just seems like he was so well liked and loved in the music scene, particularly in the realm of the orchestra and music education. He taught at Juilliard, and so his influence is just huge here, and I think that there's just so much to dive into with his music. And if you're looking for an underrated American composer to start with, William Schumann.
Right, and it's so funny. He has all these connections with such big names, Leonard Bernstein, Aaron Copland, Koussevitzky, huge names that most people that are familiar with orchestral music are very familiar with.
Right.
Yet, William Schumann is very seldom mentioned when talking about any of those people or about American music in general.
Yes.
I think he's much more well-known in the band scene, like I said before. I think his wind band works are more well-known, which is baffling when you look at his orchestral music and his
yeah.
orchestral output.
I mean, it's huge, and definitely these works need some more programming. And it's also worth noting his influence on some of his students that he had personally. Carigliano is one of those.
Yeah, I really didn't know that, and I think there was something that was passed along for sure. Because yeah, there's a lot of similarities there. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's two pretty fun and experimental orchestral composers of primarily the 20th century, so really cool there. Now let's move on to another 20th century composer here. We have Arthur Honegger ranking at number 47, 71 on my list, and 47 exactly on Fernando's list. So my ranking ended up not mattering so much in the average here. He's a Swiss and French composer of the 20th century, 1892 to 1955. Fernando, what do you like so much about Arthur Honegger?
Well, some people might know that he was part of the group of composers called Les Six in France. He helped pioneer that new direction for French music and new direction for music in general in this time period, the early 20th century. He has some really interesting harmony and a lot of complexity to his music a lot of the times. Often used a lot of abstract concepts or religious material and kind of combined all that into something that is sometimes secular and sometimes sacred. And I think that is a really fine line that he toes really well. He's right on the line of sacred and secular in a really exciting way. And again, a new direction for music that I really enjoy and I think is really, really just a lot of fun. And a fun fact here, Honegger was obsessed with trains. He was fascinated by trains. And you see that in some of his music. Some of it can have that mechanistic quality to it, particularly some of the pieces that are kind of about trains. He has some that are yeah. literally about trains. Mm-hmm. He just had a real love for locomotives.
That's a cool fact. And well, my rationale is a lot more simple, I guess. I got to dive into some more Honegger. I love his five symphonies, his liturgical symphony in particular, and they're just great additions to the orchestral repertoire, and his output is just huge. There's a lot of music across a lot of different genres that I'm still kind of discovering. So speaking of pieces that I'm still discovering, Fernando, why don't you introduce our listening for today?
So we have a solo flute piece by Honegger, Danse de la Chèvre. Let's take a listen. That was Danse de la Chèvre by Arthur Honegger. And if you're unfamiliar with French, that actually means Dance of the Goat, which is a little bit funny when you consider that this is a flute piece.
I mean, I guess if you're playing the flute for the herd of goats, maybe that's it. I don't know. I usually don't equate the two.
Right.
Too much, but interesting listening here, and there's a little bit of that funkiness in here, though. There's some interesting stuff harmonically he plays with in this, and I'm like, this is really quite intriguing and entrancing for a solo flute piece.
Yeah, and what I enjoy about it, you can tell that it's Honegger almost immediately. It's very much in his style, and he also wasn't afraid to take those risks in instrumentation. To write a piece for just flute by itself, no accompaniment, could have been a little bit of a risk at the time.
Right.
It wasn't super common. It existed for sure before then, but that's not going to be making him money, right? Mm-hmm. As much money as something a little bit larger of an ensemble or something, at least with accompaniment, might have made him.
Right. And what's interesting about Honegger here is that his earliest influences were actually the influences of Richard Wagner and Richard Strauss. So very, very experimental composers that did a lot in terms of the orchestra. And so Honegger actually commuted back and forth to Paris to study at the Paris Conservatory twice a week. And he was also students alongside Germain Taillefer and Darius Milhaud, who he became very close to. And that leads to his involvement in the Les Six, like we said earlier, with Georges Auric, Louis Duret, Milhaud, Poulenc, and Germain Taillefer. So this avant-garde group of composers, they meant to discuss art and music as well as collaborate with each other in other works, have become kind of notorious in the eyes of music history alongside of like the Mighty Handful, the Russian Five. So just another one of these groups of composers to be aware of here. And so Honegger is known for his large-scale orchestral works and his ballets and operas and choral works. He also wrote several scores for radio shows and film, interestingly. So it just shows that we're starting to get into this time period where that kind of music is intersecting with the more traditional forms of entertainment at the time.
Honegger once notably said, "I have always loved locomotives passionately. For me, they are living creatures, and I love them as others love women or horses."
What a goofy quote that is.
Well, yeah, what a goofy quote for sure. I think it's a really fun one. And it shows you how he was really into trains.
Yeah,
I mean,
he
was
really into
very
trains.
Interested. So definitely check out Pacific 231 if you're also interested in trains. Maybe not as much, but if you are, go for it.
Honegger, really fun one there. So let's go ahead and move on to composer number 48 on the list. This is Hector Berlioz, ranked number 52 on my list and 67 on Fernando's. He's a French romantic composer from 1803 to 1869. He's kind of known to be this pioneer of orchestral color. Berlioz would really lay the groundwork for a lot of romantic and 20th century composers in many ways, most of all his prowess in orchestration and how he conveys emotion with orchestration. Wagner would borrow a lot from that. Strauss would borrow a lot from that. So definitely really influential in that realm.
Yeah, and he's kind of the first person to really, really go for it in the programmatic style of the Romantic period. His music serves the purpose of the program much more than the inverse,
yeah,
where he definitely had a story in mind before he wrote the music rather than composing the music and going, oh, this kind of sounds like this.
Right, as opposed to Beethoven.
Right, and it was very clear what he was going for in a lot of his compositions, and he communicates his ideas and stories so well through his music. Another big thing that he did at this early point in the Romantic period, he kind of starts to dissolve some of the rigidity of the classical period, of the structure and form of the classical period, because it didn't suit his needs for the program.
Right.
It didn't suit his needs for his storytelling. So he kind of manipulates it and morphs it the way that he wants. He's got some really tuneful melodies throughout all of his music, with some unique non-standard harmonies, again, breaking the rigidity and rules of the classical period directly after the classical period.
Oh, yeah. I think that that's huge right there. And people just think that the Romantic period happened. No, it was a very much kind of this transformative process for all musicians, and Berlioz really helped move that along. So, Fernando, what are we going to listen to today by Hector Berlioz?
Well, we'll be listening to Berlioz's March the Scaffold from Symphonie Fantastique. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
Hector Berlioz, Symphonie Fantastique, the fourth movement, March to the Scaffold. And who was writing for bassoon like this at the time? Those bassoon solos, absolutely crazy. Not to mention these brass interjections that are really giving character to this work. There is a larger story, a very programmatic story behind this work, and it involves opium and lost loves and just craziness from all sides. So there's a lot to really dig into here, and maybe we'll do that on a larger analysis episode of this piece. But ultimately, I think that this is just such a landmark work in terms of orchestration and programmatic works.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it really shows that he wasn't afraid to share the love with the melody and give it to different instruments that other people really weren't thinking about giving the melody to. And it gives it a very unique color to the sound. It gives it a unique orchestration that could only be Hector Berlioz. So some really great stuff there. And I was just looking this up because I thought it was so interesting to think about this, the context of this piece. You think about this piece that we just listened to, the excerpt that we just listened to, and then think about late Mozart works.
Right.
They're only separated by about 40 years.
Wow.
The death of Mozart, 1791, and Symphonie Fantastique composed in 1830.
That's so crazy.
Just under 40 years apart, and they're so wildly different.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can hear some echoes of Mozart in there, but ultimately what he's doing with orchestration is just so much more colorful and so much more expansive.
Yeah. Yeah. And just the approach to music in general is so different.
Berlioz was kind of a unique guy. A lot of people kind of put him alongside Granger and some of these others there. And he had some strange tendencies and some weird directions he went, but he did do a lot in terms of orchestration. His father wanted him to follow in his footsteps to become a medical doctor, and while he's at medical college, Berlioz actually defies his parents and leaves to school to study at the Paris Conservatory, where he won the Prix de Rome at the Paris Conservatory in 1830, coincidentally the same year that he wrote Symphonie Fantastique. So during this time, he's exposed to the music of Beethoven and the writings of the poet and author Goethe, and while he's at the conservatory, and those become some of his great influences. Makes sense with Goethe there, the storytelling aspect of his music, who would also influence composers like Franz Schubert as well. Berlioz is a friend of Liszt, and Chopin, and Paganini, and Victor Hugo as well. So there's just a lot of great artistic relationships there. He did have kind of this aggressive pursuit of this young actress, Harriet Smithson, during this time, who was kind of forced into saying yes after 7 years, and that's kind of not cool, and definitely knocks Berlioz down a few pegs on the list, because he really aggressively was pursuing her, and after inviting her to a concert with these celebrities like Liszt and Chopin and Paganini and Victor Hugo in the audience, she's kind of persuaded into saying yes. But it kind of shows you that Berlioz was like a little bit scummy in that way. But I also have a feeling that there is like he was not quite all there mentally. So,
yeah. Definitely an odd character. On a much lighter note, something that also exemplifies his odd character, he actually was self-taught in composition, and the instruments that he played were actually flute and guitar. Very uncommon for
that's
composers.
That's why he wrote like the bassoon like that.
Right.
That's a guitar line right there. Like, that's totally a guitar line.
There. Right. Yeah, very uncommon instruments for composers of the time.
Yeah, very interesting there.
Right, so it just shows that he was definitely an odd character in some way.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's move on to someone that's a little bit more straight-laced in that way. This is number 49, Edvard Grieg, who we've talked about a lot on the show. I'm going to have to read you my embarrassing number that I did for Grieg, and this was before I was really into a lot of his works besides Peer Gynt and some of his other more famous works. I had him ranked number 96, criminally low compared to Fernando's 25, Norwegian romantic composer. Fernando, take it away.
Right, so Grieg, living from 1843 to 1907, so pretty squarely in that romantic period, maybe a little bit of the turn of the century time period. Mostly programmatic works from Grieg, though, so very romantic style. Very tuneful and well-structured works. His music has been included in plenty of films and television shows, mostly orchestral and piano works from Grieg, and all of them equally tuneful and equally great. We've talked about Grieg pretty extensively, but I just keep falling in love with his music more and more the more I listen to it. So a really, really great composer here. Yeah, and if you haven't listened to the Nordic Composers episode, he's featured on that one very extensively. So check that one out for even more biographical information about Grieg.
Yes, absolutely. And we have a great listening selection for you today. This is Peer Gynt, Suite Number 1, one of our favorite works by Grieg. He also has some others, but this is one we have available for you today. And I think we're going to listen to Anitra's Dance from this. Let's go ahead and take a listen.
Thank you.
That was Edvard Grieg's Anitra's Dance from Peer Gynt Suite Number 1. A really just fun, lighthearted piece or movement from this work that just has this, there's something to it that has a really almost haunting, but still, it is dance-like. I mean, yeah. Obviously from the title you would expect it. It has this sway to it, and it featured a lot in TV and commercials, even on YouTube. Sometimes people will throw that into their videos, not knowing fully what the piece is about or anything.
But. Right. I think that there's something with the quality of this recording that's kind of stately a little bit. I think you mentioned earlier, and it's certainly kind of a different interpretation. I think people usually take this a little bit faster, but I think I might prefer it this way.
Yeah, it is really nice, and it has an elegance to it when it's taken a little bit slower.
Right.
And I kind of like that. It is nice.
It just goes to show that, I mean, this great orchestration really is so flexible and can be interpreted a couple of different ways. So a couple of interesting facts about Edvard Grieg. If you want to learn more about him, check out our third episode, our Nordic Composers episode, released a couple months ago. While Grieg was in Leipzig, he would actually visit Tchaikovsky at his house pretty often there. And Tchaikovsky actually intended to dedicate his Fifth Symphony, one of my favorite symphonies of all time, to Grieg, but it ended up being his Hamlet overture that he dedicated to him instead. Cool relationship there. Now, let's talk about Granger a little bit. Granger was the last visitor to Grieg's home in Norway, which I found quite interesting. Granger really heavily promoted Grieg's music through performance and recordings and essays, and there was kind of a whole backstory to that. Grieg actually greatly admired Granger as a pianist, but Granger was not completely aware of that. Granger didn't really truly find out what Grieg thought of him until Grieg's diary was released in 1934, nearly three decades after they met. So, interesting relationship between some composers here.
Yeah, Grieg is kind of the intersection between so many great composers and so many great personalities in general. But
yeah.
He's kind of the cool-headed one, and he was just cranking out some really tuneful music and really fun music, really programmatic music. Pairs nicely with Berlioz in that way.
Absolutely, yes. Now let's go ahead and move on to our final composer for today. We talk a lot about Grieg on that Nordic Composers episode, but this is number 50, Sir William Walton, our second Sir of the list today. He's ranked number 98 on my list and 28 on Fernando's. This is another one that I'm embarrassed to say is so low on my list because I just wasn't that familiar with the work of Walton at the time. But man, I am glad we get to talk about Sir William Walton today. He's an English 20th century composer, born in 1902, passed away in 1983. He's definitely underrated in the realm of symphonic repertoire. I don't really see his music get programmed too often. He has a really diverse collection of compositions across chamber music and choral music and other shorter orchestral works, but his two symphonies are incredibly underrated. They are so, so great and have found themselves in my rotation really often this week and definitely going to continue to do so.
Yeah, his symphonic writing is wonderful, and I will also be listening to a little bit more of that this week because I had just a little bit of a taste this week just to refresh my memory, and it was just as good as I remembered, so I'll definitely be listening to that a little bit more. I really appreciate that Walton branched out into some more modern styles over time. He kind of started a little bit more traditional, but moved on quite a bit to some more experimental stuff later. Nothing too crazy, nothing like Satie or or Defia, but still something new. And he often actually revised his works, which is really interesting because that led him to not having a lot of output. In this case, he has two symphonies, mm-hmm. which is still a pretty substantial amount, but not as many as, say, somebody like Mahler.
Yes, absolutely.
So he had a smaller output or fewer pieces, but they were very impressive pieces. The final product is always really impressive because he revised so much and was very meticulous and detailed in his work.
What's interesting here with Sir William Walton is that He's kind of the bridge in between the time of Ray Vaughan Williams and Benjamin Britten, which is really interesting to note because two British titans that are viewed in history, but William Walton fits in between and after these composers. It's really interesting to see how his music is similar and dissimilar, because I think that he does end up taking a lot more risks in his lifetime, but it's not as evident because of the output maybe is not as large as those two composers.
Right, and it's also literally in between in time. Right. Vaughan Williams is a little bit earlier and Britten's a little bit later. So Britten can take a little bit more of those risks because other composers were taking more of those risks. And it was very common at the time. We don't have listening today for Walton, but if you listen to it, I think you will hear the similarities between Vaughan Williams and Walton and Walton and Britten. And I also think you'll hear his very unique voice. He does have a unique voice. As you can tell, I mean, even Vaughan Williams and Britten are different in their own compositional approaches. And so Walton also has his unique voice. There are just some overlapping similarities that just happen to occur.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit more about some facts about Sir William Walton. He studied at the University of Oxford. He had great interest in the music of Debussy and Ravel and Prokofiev and Stravinsky, which definitely fits the character of having a unique voice there. He completed his studies at Oxford, but failed to pass the final exam to receive the degree. So that's kind of heartbreaking there. But the funny thing is, over his career, he received 7 honorary doctorate degrees throughout, including one from Oxford. So Oxford eventually was like, okay, we messed up, so we're going to give him that honorary doctorate. And then he was also knighted in 1951. A couple other facts. Fernando found this one really interesting. Paul Hindemith actually performed Walton's Viola Concerto at its premiere. So they had a little bit of a back and forth kind of a friendship there. So more interesting links there.
Right. And it's interesting that it's a viola concerto, right? It's very uncommon to have a viola concerto. And Walton's Viola Concerto is one of the premier works in the viola rep, in the viola solo repertoire, because it's so substantial and so demanding, but also just a great piece of music.
Yeah, and unique too.
Yeah,
so I think
unique.
That's worth noting for sure. Walton overall is known for his orchestral output as well as film scores. A lot of film scores on today's list. Some works for the stage, voice, and chamber works. Definitely worth checking out. I'd start with those symphonies and that viola concerto. I think that that's 3 great pieces to start with William Walton. Also his Crown Imperial.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Yes, Crown Imperial is just fantastic and so stately and elegant. And one of our favorites in the band repertoire, for sure.
Right. If we were going to redo the graduation ceremony as a whole, I think I would substitute Pomp and Circumstance for Crown Imperial.
Yes. As much as we love Elgar, that Crown Imperial is just way too good.
And, yeah.
I want to walk down the aisle to that for sure for graduation.
Yeah. For any kind of ceremony. It just feels really, really elegant. And it is a coronation march kind of subtitled as such. So a really great piece there. I would start with what Alex said and Crown Imperial, because those are just really great works and really fun works by Sir William Walton.
Absolutely. And with that, we have gone over 50 composers in this series, this Top 100 Composer series. We would like to remind you that these are our personal preferences averaged, so it is in no way, shape, or form saying that, for example, Sir William Walton is ranked number 50 in composers. No, it's just our personal taste here and kind of a little bit of a window into our personal preferences. So it is nothing more, nothing less. You cannot rank art.
Right.
So that's important to note here. Well, Fernando, I think it's time we start to wrap this episode up. Kind of a long one, because this is a really unique group of composers. And there's a good mix of composers that we're really, really passionate about, and then some that we're kind of learning still about. So I think that it was worth spending this amount of time, and we hope that you guys enjoyed. And be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast. That helps us a lot to be able to see what you guys like or don't like about what we're doing. And if there's pieces that you maybe want to hear or suggestions you have, we would really, really love to hear them, because we want to keep improving the show and we would love your input.
Right. So leave a review if you like, or you could also email us or reach out through social media. All of that information is provided in the outro, so take a listen to that.
Right. So be sure to join us next Monday for some more of the Leading Tone podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at The Leading Tone Podcast with no spaces on Instagram, and The Leading Tone Podcast on Facebook.
Thanks again, and tune in next Monday for more of The Leading Tone Podcast.